More than 9 million coronavirus cases worldwide, cases exploding in the United States, and more on the D614G mutation. We'll explain what that means and why. It looks like that's going to be conferring additional infectivity as well as the possibility of explaining some of the secondary infections that we've been seeing. Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Chris Martinson. I am here with your update on SARS-CoV-2. It's June 23rd, 2020. Let's go right to the numbers. Remember last time I talked about this Dallas woman was battling the coronavirus again. And so I want to talk about why that might be right now. And here we're going to get into something called the D614G mutation. All right, this is back in the news. Hey, John Mihokovic, thank you very much for bringing my attention to this and writing to me on Twitter saying what's going on with this D614G mutation here, Chris. A lot of new cases here in Florida, many other places. Seems like it's learning how to infect better. And we got to go to this article here, which talks about how approximately 70% of COVID-19 samples globally now show the substantially more infective and apparently infectious D614G strain of SARS-CoV-2. All right, what is that D614? So that's, let me decode that. The D is aspartic acid, and the G is glycine. Those are two amino acids that exist at the 614 position on a very long string of amino acids. So position 614 used to be aspartic acid, but then it switched and became glycine. That was a mutation. It was a single point mutation where one amino acid was swapped out and became a different one. And because of that, it seems to have much, much higher infectivity and infectiousness. So imagine that, a single point mutation where one amino acid became a different one seems to be able to have conferred a much, much greater degree of infectivity to this. So here's the data that's coming out now. We've got two big pieces of it. This first comes out of a paper that's not yet been peer-reviewed, but it's in peer review right now. So we're getting kind of a preprint view of this thing. It says, mutated coronavirus shows significant boost in infectivity. Here is the big giant, this is the S protein right here. This is the spike protein that would be all over the outside of the virus particle. And it's in here are the receptor binding domains and the S2 subunit, which needs to be proteolytically cleaved. And fortunately, there's a polybasic furin cleavage site right there at the S1, S2 boundary. Kind of interesting how that got there. People should ask, hey, where did that polybasic furin cleavage site come from? That's an interesting question. But we're going to leave that one aside because right now we're talking about the D614G mutation. And this article reads, a tiny genetic mutation in the SARS coronavirus 2 variant circulating throughout Europe in the United States significantly increases the virus's ability to infect cells. Lab experiments performed at Scripps Research show. Viruses with this mutation were much more infectious than those without the mutation in the cell culture system we used, says this virologist here. The mutation had the effect of markedly increasing the number of functional spikes on the viral surface, she added. Those spikes are what allow the virus to bind to and infect cells. So functional spikes. It increased the number of functional spikes. So not all the spikes apparently are functional, but because of this mutation, many, many more of them are markedly increased. More of them are. The number or density of functional spikes on the virus is 4 or 5 times greater due to this mutation. So if the 4 to 5 times more spikes are functional, that means there's a much greater chance that when that virus is sort of wobbling around in you know, the liquids in your body, that it will bump into and be able to latch onto one of the many receptors it seems to be able to latch onto, which includes neuropilin now. We've got the CD147 and, of course, ACE2 and probably some others. This thing is just really quite a beast because it tends to bind to so many different receptors. And that, I think, is in part why we're going to get into some of the disturbing data that's coming up now about how it's very hard to get rid of this completely once you've had it. All right. The spikes give the coronavirus's crown-like appearance and enable it to latch onto target cell receptors called ACE2, as I mentioned some other ones too, right? The mutation called D614G provides greater flexibility to the spike's backbone, explains co-author Michael Farzan, co-chairman of the Scripps Research Department of Immunology and Microbiology. More flexible spikes allow newly made viral particles to navigate the journey from producer cell to target cell fully intact, with less tendency to fall apart prematurely. All right, that's new to me. I didn't know that viral particles fell apart prematurely. So I guess they get inactivated somehow. So falling apart, I guess, is part of that. I'm going to have to look into that. I don't know anything about that. But at any rate, while the virus particle is infectious or infective, then these new spikes seem to make it allow it to journey much more rapidly somehow. Our data are very clear. The virus becomes much more stable with the mutation. I guess that Hyun Cho says here for this. That's the lead author. But Farzan and Cho note a key structural difference between spike proteins on the first SARS virus and this new pandemic strain. With both, under an electron microscope, the spike has a tripod shape, with its three segments bound together at a backbone-like scaffold. But SARS-CoV-2 is different. Its tripod is divided into two discrete segments, S1 and S2. Initially, this unusual feature produced unstable spikes, Farzan says. Only about a quarter of the hundreds of spikes on each SARS-CoV-2 virus maintain the structure they need to successfully infect a target cell. With the mutation, the tripod breaks much less frequently, meaning more of its spikes are fully functional. All right, that's cool. So that makes a lot of sense to me. So there's a conformational shape of these of the spike proteins, and with this mutation, it's just more stable. It just happens to persist in the shape it needs to in order to latch on to the target cell. So that's an interesting finding right there. And we're finding more and more about this virus all the time. And I think we're going to continue to learn about it. And I think we've got both some pleasant and unpleasant surprises in store for us as we go forward. Pleasant would be things where we learn how we can inactivate it, how we can treat for it, how we can really reduce its impact on the human body once it gets in there. The unpleasant surprises are going to be potentially what the long-term impacts are and things like that. The addition of the D614G mutation means that the amino acid at that location is switched from aspartic acid to glycine. That renders it more bendable, Farzan says. Evidence of its success can be seen in the sequence strains that scientists globally are contributing to databases, including GenBank, the Duo report. In February, no sequences deposited to GenBank database showed the D614G mutation, but by March, it appears in 1 out of 4 samples, and in May, it appeared in 70% of samples. Over time, it has figured out how to hold on better and not fall apart until it needs to. The virus has, under selection pressure, made itself more stable. All right, we talked about the D614G mutation a month and a half ago. I forget, sometime when it first started to show up back in March, and we didn't know a lot about it. The questions at the time were, listen, was there any, it's an interesting mutation, but was it associated with any additional clinical severity or different clinical outcomes? And we didn't have any data around that. We're starting to get a little bit of data sneaking in now. This comes from Thailand Medical News, maybe a little bit strong language here, a little alarmist maybe, saying, warning, the D614G mutation coronavirus strains from Europe could render those recovered from earlier strains defenseless, according to China. All right, let's read in on this. This article reads, according to warnings from Chinese researchers, individuals infected with earlier SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus strains, we'll call those COVID classic, could be defenseless against the more aggressive European strains with the D614G mutations. This would have implications. Oh, yeah. Oh, look at this cool picture. I don't know what this has to do with anything. excuse me. But I left it in anyway because it's got DNA in it. Everything's cooler with DNA. All right. This would have implications for countries like Japan, South Korea, most of the Southeast Asian countries, and even China itself, as most of the individuals infected in the early parts of the crisis were infected with the middle strains. The Chinese researchers say that the antibodies found in blood of individuals who have fought disease previously failed to stop the D614G strain. The mutant form was identified in genetic data of samples collected at Xinfadi Food Market in Beijing, where the latest outbreak just began. Chinese authorities are saying that previously recovered COVID-19 patients in China may still be vulnerable to a mutant form of the pathogen spreading overseas. All right, now we have some data now maybe for why China reacted so strongly to the Xinfadi Food Market outbreak in Beijing. They canceled thousands of flights. you know, just a huge, huge testing program going on, lots and lots of contact tracing. They listen, China just doesn't want this strain or any strain of COVID to take off again. But I think they're a little bit worried about the D614G strain in particular, because they did identify it pretty rapidly there. All right. So that makes more sense now, how and why China reacted so strongly to this as well. All right. This article, this is from the same article here. This continues. Professor Dr. Huang Ailong from the Chongqing Medical University said that there's an urgent need to determine what threat the mutation known as D614G poses to people who have recovered from a different form of the virus. Also worrisome is that the new strain could actually be more worse the second time around in patients who were previously infected with the milder strains and have recovered, but there is no clinical proof of this yet. No clinical proof. So that's just supposition at this point. The strain with the D614G mutation began spreading in Europe in early February and May, dominant strain around the world now, and is now present in India, Iran, Middle East, Brazil as well. Chinese researchers say antibodies found in patients who had been infected with the earlier forms of the pathogen failed to neutralize this new mutant strain. All right. Ever since the latest coronavirus outbreak was reported at the Zhenhai wholesale market in Beijing, 228 new infections have been confirmed and more than 2.2 million residents have been tested for COVID-19 in a bid to contain the spread. Look at the reaction on that. 228 new cases, 2.2 million residents then get tested. That's just astonishing because, I don't know, what's the other way you could do this? I don't know. Maybe, who knows? 50,000 people don't even know how they got this thing. Who knows? What are you going to do? Impossible. Can't be done. But apparently it can be done. This is how China does it. I'm not saying that's the right way, but it is possible. So that's just showing you also how seriously China is taking this with 2.2 million residents tested because 228 new cases came in. Here's the punchline for this article, why I wanted to get all the way to here. Roughly about 12% of the individuals infected by the new outbreak in Beijing are in a critical condition, according to the Beijing health authorities, and medical teams from across the country have been flown in to help with the aid effort. 12% of the individuals are in a critical condition. So that's pretty important information right there. All right. So this is starting to fit a larger pattern, which looks like this, that we're seeing slow or no recovery for many people. So this just came out very recently. This is in the Times of Israel. Recovered COVID-19 patients suffer major ongoing physical and cognitive problems. Article reads, as coronavirus patients recover from the illness, doctors and patients are discovering that COVID-19 is leaving the, quotes, recovered with long-term debilitating physical, cognitive, and psychiatric damage, and sometimes even in people who only suffered mild symptoms. Patients are suffering from phantom pains, memory loss, personality changes, psychological issues, and extreme fatigue, along with lungs that won't heal, even months after being discharged from hospital, according to an investigation by Israel's Channel 12 TV. Let's continue on here. Afik Suisa, 24, was one of Israel's youngest patients to be hospitalized. Only 24, huh? And ventilated in serious condition, a resident of the southern port city of Ashdod, Suisa was hospitalized at the end of March. He had recently been in the U.S. with two friends touring Miami and then Las Vegas. The three returned to the country and Suisa immediately went into home quarantine in accordance with health ministry guidelines, but he quickly developed a fever that became worse and was hospitalized. Within days, his condition had deteriorated so much he was put on a ventilator, which required sedation and the insertion of a breathing tube. Oh, yeah, once you get ventilated, it's not good. He eventually recovered and was discharged from the hospital last month, but he has since developed several issues, including phantom pains in one leg that require him to have physical therapy. The nerve in my foot is sending messages of pain to the brain, he said in the TV report Friday night. It causes me to limp because I feel that there's a wound there, he said, even though there's no discernible injury. He also has an altered sense of taste. The 24-year-old, who was a healthy basketball player, also now has high blood pressure and pulse rate and is on blood thinners that he might have to take his whole life. He also feels he's had a change in personality. I have less patience with people, he said, adding that he now frequently gets upset and finds himself angry over trivial things. I raise my voice over things that are not legitimate. Nonsense. All right. This is very concerning because this is showing that even in, well, he had a serious case, obviously, but even in people who had so-called mild cases, we've been building this data for some time now that, first off, the people who are serious, who have the critical cases, who have obviously the bilateral ground glass lung opacities and things like that, they very well may have lifelong lung impairment. The fibrotic damage to their lungs is just too much to overcome. It's not reparable. The other thing we're seeing, though, is more and more of these sorts of mystery ailments. This is mysterious to me. This guy's got a shooting pain in his leg. He's got loss of sense of smell. So clearly the nervous system is getting attacked here. Clearly this is attacking the blood system. In particular, it looks mostly like a coagulation disease more than anything else. But the anosmia, loss of sense of smell, plus the leg pains, the phantom pains, things like that, say it's possibly attacking the nerve tissue as well. And, of course, we have all sorts of issues around kidney stuff, liver function, all sorts of things. So this is a very, very serious disease. And for the people who are out there saying, well, the fatality is really low, that's, you know, you just have to learn to live with a little extra fatality, no big deal, right? In fact, we have to understand what do we mean when we say recovered, because this person, Afik Suisa, clearly falls into recovered. There are lots and lots and lots of cases, hundreds and thousands of cases that I've been able to come across just like this, which the people would show up in the recovered column, but I don't think you and I would necessarily consider them recovered. So this is just my invitation to you to continue to take the honey badger virus seriously. You don't want it. You want to avoid it if you can. How do you do that? Wear a mask. Have everybody around you wear a mask. And if you're in a place where people aren't wearing masks, don't be there. All right. I think what some of this means is that we have to begin to learn to live with the risk of death again. I don't think we're going to get away with get rid of this COVID very easily. This was an interesting, I just pulled this one little snippet out from a pretty fascinating interview here with a Dr. Hazeltine, Juan Guaido. This is at Danny Bot. Thank you very much for putting this to my attention here. So let's just listen in on this one part of this whole thing, because I think this professor, William Hazeltine, had a very good point of view here. Let's listen in.
So it's not a slight bump. It's 20,000 of our citizens, which means there are about 200,000 people walking around with active infections at any one time in the U.S., and they have been for a long time. So we have not controlled it. We are not controlling it. But that doesn't mean we're not going to reopen. We will reopen. And we're going back to a period at the beginning of my life when antibiotics were just coming in at the end of World War II for civilian use. Penicillin had been discovered. But before that, when we were building our railroads, when we were building our cities, we lived with a possibility that tomorrow would not come. Everybody knew that an infection could spell death. We're back to that era. And by the way, it's something that many of us predicted, that there would come a time, there would come a disease that would take us back to the pre-antibiotic days. The world doesn't end. Your world may end, but mankind goes on and economies go on.
I think that was a very good point. We're just basically back to the future here, and we now have among us a disease that we can't control. And that's how people lived for a very, very, for all of human history practically, except for this brief little window where antibiotics were able to rule the roost and give us a relief from spontaneous and bacterial infections, and we didn't really have these sorts of viral infections coming around that we now have. So we had a window there where I think people formed an idea that we could always be safe from this sort of infectious disease that could come and take you out. But Hazeltine here is making the great point that this is just how things used to be, and we're getting back to that. So we're back to living with the risk of death there. I think that's a great point. I do want to just as well, just I received several people sent this to me, which was another paper and point of view by this guy, Dr. Ioannidis. Nobody, this is all him all by himself. Nobody's signing up this time to be a co-author on this particular article right here. Stanford's reputation is swirling and not upwards. It's swirling in a downward sort of a direction here. With every piece that this guy releases, I'm just very unimpressed with what Ioannidis is coming up with here, and on an ongoing basis. But here's what I need to talk about. At any rate, he did a meta study, looked at results of 23 different studies where they were looking at the seroprevalence. So they're doing the antibody test. And so we're identified with usable data. I don't know what he means by usable data to enter into calculations. Seroprevalence estimates range from 0.1% to 47%. So 47% seroprevalence. Tell you what, John, you might want to toss that one out because that's ridiculous. I think 0.1% is probably ridiculous as well, unless that was some weird country that hadn't had any infections yet or something like that. But 47%, no, not happening. Infection fatality rates range from 0.02% to 0.86%, a median of 0.26%. And corrected values range from 0.02 to 0.78, a median of 0.25. So infection fatality rates of 0.25%. And among people under 70 years of age, infection fatality rates range from 0 to 0.26. I don't know who's got 0. Nobody gets 0. Sorry, John. With a median of 0.04%. So that's what people were sending around to me saying, hey, Chris, COVID's not that bad. It has a death rate, an infection fatality rate of 0.04%. All right, let's go back and just cover these terms again. I did this a number of months ago, but let's just, so we can all be on the same page, see what we got here. The mortality rate versus the case fatality rate versus the infection fatality rate. Those are three things. So first, the mortality rate is deaths from the disease divided by the total population. This is going to be the smallest number you can have because we're dividing the total population into deaths from disease, right? Whereas a case fatality rate is deaths from the disease divided by the total cases of people who are infected. So cases that are showing up in the hospitals. And if you have deaths from the disease divided by total infected, I'm going to have to change this right here right now because this should be our infection fatality rate. Yeah. So that's our infection fatality rate. And then this is deaths from cases, deaths from disease, total cases, because not everybody's a case. Okay. So these are total cases. All right, now that I've got that all squared away. So we got our mortality rate, we got our infection fatality rate, which is going to be a slightly higher number than the mortality rate because now we're just dividing deaths from the disease, which is the same numerator here, by total infected. Total population, oh, it's a much, much larger number than total infected. So if only half the population is infected, this is going to be half the size of that number up there, right? So if total infected is half... If total infected is half the size of total population, this will be a half the size. So this will be a much larger number. And then the case fatality rate, deaths from the disease divided by total cases, this is going to be your highest number, right? So 1, 2, 3, this is your lowest number. This is going to be your medium size number here. And then this is going to be your highest number right here. And an example would be if we had 1,000 people in our population, 100 were infected and 10 died, then our mortality rate would be the 10 dead divided by the 1,000. That would be 1%. Excuse me. Whereas if we had 10 dead and 100 infected here, we would have a 10% infection fatality rate. Okay? So just wanted to make sure we're clear on that because he's saying in this paper that there's going to be an infection fatality rate of about 0.04%. So time for some math. Here's some math. Let's get to it. What I've done here is I've taken the data that we have right now from Worldometers and just did a quick little spreadsheet table here. So I'm looking at here mortality. So what I've done for this table right here is I've taken the total deaths right here, for example, for the United States, and I've divided it by the total population of the United States, in this case around 320 million. And what you find is that the mortality rate here is about 0.04%, right? It's very low in a place like India, which has got 1.3 billion people and is just getting started. So that's a very, very low number. But we see other places like the UK has a number like 0.06%, or Spain clocking in at 0.06%, right? And they're not even done with this disease at this point in time, right? So as they get more and more deaths racking up, this mortality rate is going to be going up. And again, this mortality rate is the lowest possible percentage you can possibly have in this story. And we're already seeing here that the mortality rates in major countries are already well over 0.04%, like France, right? Whereas what John was saying here in his paper, Ioannidis, and by the way, there's a typo right there in the very first word. You want to fix that. You want to fix that right there. Scratch that. So to say that the infection fatality rate is only 0.04%, it's already higher than that. It's already higher than that on a mortality basis. In an infection basis, this would be very, very large number. So let's look at the case fatality rate here, which is our highest number. Look at these here. You know, for the case fatality rate, I'm taking total deaths and dividing it by recovered plus total deaths on the bottom. Look at these numbers. 10.9%, 8%, 2.3%, 5.3%, 5.4%, 15.8% here for Italy, 13.9% for Mexico, 28.4% for France. Oh, my God. I mean, geez, look at these numbers, right? So these are the case fatality rates. So to suggest that it's a very, very low number is just not right. Again, this is just... this is junk. This is, again, another junk paper by Ioannidis. And I'm very sorry, Stanford, but you may want to figure out how to rein that in, because this is just useless, but people are clinging onto it and taking it out there and saying, look, we don't need to wear masks and we can just get out in public because, gosh, look at those odds. I'll play those odds any day of the week. Gotcha. All right, but masks work. We now have a lot of data around that. The faster a country required masks, the fewer coronavirus deaths it had. That's a study that just came out. And some countries have been devastated and others have escaped lightly. Why the extreme differences? The main one is that the countries that quickly resorted to widespread mask wearing had far lower death rates and shorter outbreaks, a new study argues. I'm not sure if argues is the right word there. The authors looked at coronavirus death rates in 198 countries, trying to see why some had painfully high death rates, others very low. What we found was that one of the big variables you can control, which influenced mortality, was one was wearing masks, says Christopher Leffler of Virginia Commonwealth University. It wasn't just by a few percent, it was up to 100 times less mortality. The countries that introduced masks from the very beginning of their outbreaks have had hardly any deaths. Why? Because you have a lower inoculum, because you have a lower rate of spread, because your hospital system doesn't get overwhelmed for lots of reasons. So wearing masks works. Let's just say, come on, people, get on with it. Can we just get to wearing masks? Please, 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 please. All right. Remember last time I told you, you know, grapes for them, cucumbers for us. I'm very concerned about the direction of things with the central banks now just printing money, throwing it into the markets, making the rich richer. And of course, I fight for fairness because I don't want to live in a failed state. I think that would be great if we could avoid that. It doesn't have to be this way. We can totally not do this way, but we're doing it this way for now. And of course, Jerome Powell is out there with his let them eat stocks sayings, and it's just awful. It's just awful right now. So I really wish we weren't going down this path, but here we are. I think there's going to be more social unrest as the summer spreads, and we're going to have more coronavirus cases. All right, here are my conclusions and summaries for today. The U.S. is mismanaging SARS-CoV-2, managing it poorly. Out of reserves, that's it. We're basically giving up. We're just at the shrug stage. Like, I don't know. You know, people just get this thing. We don't know. And it's not that deadly or whatever the story is to rationalize it. The D614G mutation is very real, confers higher infectivity and seemingly seriousness to this whole thing. That's what the China data is suggesting. And as well, it's entirely possible that people who caught and battled D614, which is classic COVID, might not be immune to D614G. More and more, we're learning that recovered isn't really recovered. And that's why I don't want to get this disease at all, if possible. And that means that now in this part of the story, this is when your vigilance counts the most. I know it's hard to maintain all of the distancing and the changes to behaviors and wanting to get back to business and how things were. I totally get it. Believe me, I'm right there with you. But now is when you really want to make your vigilance add up and count for the most. It's super easy to be lulled into complacency here it's easy to shrug. It's easy to give up. It's easy to say, oh, well, I'll just get it. And, you know, hopefully I'll get the Math Plus protocol or whatever. You know, we're learning ways to really treat this better. That's all true. But what we don't know is what happens after you've had this thing for a year or the second time you get it. Or are there long-term neurological consequences? Or is this thing burning slowly in people's bodies to erupt later at some point in time? We don't know any of that. And until we do, I think it makes the most sense to just avoid getting it in the first place, if at all possible. All right. Continuing, the U.S. Federal Reserve and other central banks, they're creating really dangerous social and cultural climate right now. I think the protests can really be explained against the backdrop of deep, deep structural unfairness. And remember, if you haven't seen this video, please watch this from last time, the update I gave last week on Thursday. Grapes for them, cucumbers for us. We're just wired to not like things to be unfair. So right now, the central banks, I think they're acting like cultural vandals. They are really, really risking everything. For what? For temporarily higher stock prices so they can feel better about themselves and their actions. It's really absolutely, it's something that I just have no respect for. Zero. Zero respect for that, because it lacks all integrity in this story. So what am I going to say? You know what? It didn't have to be this way. We could wear masks. We could have given clear, consistent communication. We could have told people the same story over and over again so that we could nudge people from one set of behaviors into a new set of behaviors, the old set of behaviors. We were in condition, an unalert condition, so that, hey, you don't have to pay attention to anything, whatever. You just walk around. Sometimes you get the flu. Who cares, right? Now we have to go into a different condition where people are more armed, alert, aware of the armed with facts, or if you live in a city, maybe a gun. But I mean armed with data and information that will inform and change their behaviors so that we now know that we can't shake hands and we've got to not touch our faces. We've got to wash our hands a lot. We've got to wear masks, things like that. Well, to have done that well, we would have had leadership, not managers, and the leadership would have had to have been able to communicate that very, very clearly. All right, moving on. Remember, if you want to get a T-shirt, these resilience T-shirts from Peak Prosperity, wonderful, all organic cotton, made in the USA kind of T-shirts, feel good. This is my fiance Evie here modeling that for you there, showing what it looks like when she's holding it out. This is us in our new garden. This is me planting some stuff that's monstrous now. It's really huge. And here's some people also modeling those resilience T-shirts right there. And remember, you want to get your immune system, the terrain of your body, as tuned as possible. Make sure you are taking your daily supplements around zinc, D3, quercetin. Those are going to be some biggies right there. And selenium. If you do get sick, you get that scratchy bit in the throat, remember, your elderberry syrup is going to be just a very important thing. I like this elderberry syrup right here. It's just fantastic. Great reviews. N-acetylcysteine, vitamin C. These are all very important. And remember, resubscribe if necessary. Evie gets unsubscribed from my YouTube channel all the time, like pretty much every week. She's not subscribed anymore. I don't know why YouTube and sometimes Twitter feel it so necessary to unsubscribe people. But if you've been unsubscribed, please remember to just subscribe. You can hit the subscribe button right there, and then you'll get the notifications to know when the next video is out, and you can track us and follow us more easily. All right, with that, I am all done for today. I will see you next time. Thank you so much for listening. Be safe. Avoid the honey badger virus. And remember, it didn't have to be this way.
Hi, folks. Adam Taggart, co-founder of Peak Prosperity, here with good news. In his daily videos, Chris often refers to the book that he and I wrote, Prosper: How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. It presents a practical model for living with greater resilience, and those who read it and followed its advice were much better prepared for the coronavirus outbreak than the average household. Given its heightened relevance to the turbulent times we now find ourselves in, Chris and I want everyone to benefit from this book's formula for better, more secure living. So we're giving the book to you for free. To get your copy, simply visit peakprosperity.com/freebook. We think you'll find this an extremely valuable and inspiring resource for the current COVID-19 outbreak and for being well-positioned for any kind of crisis that comes our way in the future. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Yeah, hell yeah!
Hell yeah!
China went from a state of economic and technological exuberance in around 1000 AD to one of dense population, agrarian backwardness, and desperate poverty in 1950. According to Angus Maddison's estimates, it was the only region in the world with a lower GDP per capita in 1950 than in 1000. The blame for this lies squarely with China's governments. Pause first to admire the exuberance. China's best moments came when it was fragmented, not united. The economy first truly prospered in the unstable Zhou dynasty of the first millennium BC. Later, after the Han Empire fell apart in 220 AD, the Three Kingdoms period saw a flourishing of culture and technology. When the Tang Empire came to an end in 907, and the Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms fought each other incessantly, China experienced its most spectacular burst of invention and prosperity yet, which the Song Dynasty inherited. Even the rebirth of China in the late 20th century owes much to the fragmentation of government and to an explosion of local autonomy. The burst of economic activity in China after 1978 was driven by township and village enterprises, agencies of the government given local freedom to start companies. One of the paradoxical features of modern China is the weakness of a central, would-be authoritarian government. By the late 1000s, the Chinese were masters of silk, tea, porcelain, paper and printing, not to mention the compass and gunpowder. They used multi-spindle cotton wheels, hydraulic trip hammers, as well as umbrellas, matches, toothbrushes, and playing cards. They made coke from coal to smelt high-grade iron. They were making 125,000 tons of pig iron a year. They used water power to spin hemp yarn. They had magnificent water clocks. All across the Yangtze Delta, the Confucian dictum, men plow, women weave, was obeyed with industrious efficiency, so that peasants were working for cash as well as subsistence, and were using that cash to consume goods. Art, science, and engineering flourished. Bridges and pagodas sprang up everywhere. Woodblock printing quenched a raging thirst for literature. The Song era had, in short, a highly elaborate division of labor. Many people were consuming what each other produced. Then came the calamities of the 1200s and 1300s. First, the Mongol invasion. Then, the Black Death. Then, a series of natural disasters, followed by the all-too-unnatural disaster of totalitarian Ming rule. The Black Death, as I shall argue in the next chapter, spurred Europe into further gains from trade and escaping the trap of self-sufficiency. Why did it not have the same effect in China, where it left the country half as populous as before, and therefore presumably rich in surplus land to support disposable income? The blame rests squarely with the Ming Dynasty. Western Europe only bounced back from the Black Death because it had regions of independent city-states run by and for merchants, notably in Italy and Flanders. This made it harder for landowners to reimpose serfdom and restrictions on peasant movement after the plague had briefly empowered the laboring classes. In Eastern Europe, Mamluk Egypt, and Ming China, serfdom was effectively restored. Empires, indeed governments generally, tend to be good things at first and bad things the longer they last. First, they improve society's ability to flourish by providing central services and removing impediments to trade and specialization. Thus, even Genghis Khan's Pax Mongolica lubricated Asia's overland trade by exterminating brigands along the Silk Road, thus lowering the cost of Oriental goods in European parlors. But then, as Peter Turchin argues, following the lead of the medieval geographer Ibn Khaldun, governments gradually employ more and more ambitious elites, who capture a greater and greater share of the society's income by interfering more and more in people's lives, as they give themselves more and more rules to enforce, until they kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. There is a lesson for today. Economists are quick to speak of market failure, and rightly so. But a greater threat comes from government failure. Because it is a monopoly, government brings inefficiency and stagnation to most things it runs. Government agencies pursue the inflation of their budgets rather than the service of their customers. Pressure groups form an unholy alliance with agencies to extract more money from taxpayers for their members. Yet despite all this, most clever people still call for government to run more things and assume that if it did so, it would somehow be more perfect, more selfless next time. Not only did the Ming emperors nationalize much of industry and trade, creating state monopolies in salt, iron, tea, alcohol, foreign trade, and education, but they interfered with the everyday lives of their citizens and censored expression to a totalitarian degree. Ming officials had high social status and low salaries, a combination that inevitably bred corruption and rent-seeking. Like all bureaucrats, they instinctively mistrusted innovation as a threat to their positions and spent more and more of their energy on looking after their own interests rather than the goals they were put there to pursue. As Etienne Balage put it, the reach of the Moloch state, the omnipotence of the bureaucracy, goes much further. There are clothing regulations, a regulation of public and private construction, dimensions of houses, the colors one wears, the music one hears, the festivals, all are regulated. There are rules for birth and rules for death. The providential state watches minutely over every step of its subjects, from cradle to grave. It is a regime of paperwork and harassment, endless paperwork and endless harassment. Do not be fooled by the present tense. This is Ming, not Maoist China, that Balage is describing. The behavior of Hong Wu, the first of the Ming emperors, is an object lesson in how to stifle the economy, forbid all trade and travel without government permission, force merchants to register an inventory of their goods once a month, order peasants to grow for their own consumption and not for the market, and allow inflation to devalue the paper currency 10,000-fold. His son, Yong Lei, added some more items to the list. Move the capital at vast expense, maintain a gigantic army, invade Vietnam unsuccessfully, put your favorite eunuch in charge of a nationalized fleet of monstrous ships with 27,000 passengers, 5 astrologers, and a giraffe aboard, then, in a fit of pique at the failure of this mission to make a profit, ban everybody else from building ships or trading abroad. Yet, the Chinese were bursting to trade with the world. In the 1500s, Portuguese carracks took silk from Macau to Japan in exchange for silver. In the 1600s, junks that had slipped unofficially from the coast of Fujian arrived in Manila, laden with silk, cotton, porcelain, gunpowder, mercury, copper, walnuts, and tea. There they met a large Spanish galleon stuffed with silver from the Potosí mine in Peru, which had crossed the Pacific from Acapulco. It is no accident that when the Ming dynasty fell, weakened by the silver drought caused by the loss of 3 Acapulco galleons in 3 years, it fell to Manchu traders, who financed their conquest by the profitable exchange of goods with Korea and Japan. Part of the problem was that a Chinese artisan could not flee to work under a more tolerant ruler or in a more congenial republic, as Europeans did routinely. Because of its peninsulas and mountain ranges, Europe is much harder to unify than China. Ask Charles V, Louis XIV, Napoleon, or Hitler. For a while, the Romans achieved a sort of European unity, and the result was just like the Ming, stagnation and bureaucracy. Under the Emperor Diocletian, just as under the Emperor Yong Lei, tax collectors began to outnumber taxpayers, said Lactantius, and a multitude of governors and hordes of directors oppressed every region, almost every city, and to these were added countless collectors and secretaries and assistants to the directors. Since then, Europe had been fragmented among warring states. So, Europeans took to their heels all the time, sometimes fleeing from cruel rulers, as French Huguenots and Spanish Jews did, sometimes drawn to ambitious ones, sometimes seeking republican freedom. The Italian, Christopher Columbus, gave up on Portugal and tried Spain instead. The Sforzas lured engineers to Milan. Louis XI enticed Italian silkmakers to set up in Lyon. Johann Gutenberg moved from Mainz to Strasbourg in search of investors. Gustavus Adolphus started the Swedish iron industry by bringing in a Walloon named Louis de Geer. John Kay, English inventor of the flying shuttle, was paid 2,500 livres a year by the French authorities to tour Normandy demonstrating his machine. In one especially bizarre case of industrial poaching in the early 1700s, Augustus the Strong of Saxony got a monopoly on the manufacture of porcelain by the cunning ploy of imprisoning a passing charlatan who claimed to be able to make gold, lest any other state get him. The man in question, Johann Friedrich Böttger, made no gold, but perfected a colleague's technique for making fine porcelain in the hope that this would win him back his freedom. So Augustus locked him even more securely in a hilltop castle at Meissen and put him to work churning out teapots and vases. In short, competition was a grand incentive to European industrialization and a break on bureaucratic suffocation at the national as well as the corporate level.
Thank you. Truth Seekers, welcome back. For those of you who have a savior complex, you're going to learn a lot today. You have secret relatives out there. You have bizarro friends who've also tried to save the world, save the planet, save humanity. And many of them failed miserably. So I think there's a, what's that Horowitz quote? That inside all of us, there's a little bit of tyranny raging to get out. The next guest that I have on today has written 12 books. Holy smokes. I don't even know if I can believe that. This is going to motivate you. This is going to be like CrossFit for your mind. The most recent one is called... His podcast is History Unplugged. His most recent book is on my iPad, which just went to sleep, and it's called, page one, History's 9 Most Insane Rulers. I highly suggest you pause it, run, and buy this on Amazon, and then come back and finish listening to the show, because you're going to be jacked. His name is Scott Rank. Scott, welcome to the show. How are you?
Doing all right. Thanks for having me.
All right. Hey, I got the book up on the screen today, or at this moment, and I'm just thinking that the reason this caught my attention is this is about when we thought Kim Jong-un had disappeared, or Il-un. Which one's dying now? Which one's already dead?
Un, he came back, but he's sort of Schrodinger's dictator. He's neither alive nor dead. Maybe he's a hologram. We don't know.
Have you seen the split-screen photos of the before and after, like the fake Un and the real Un? What do you think about that?
Neither one looks good, so I don't know. Is he healthier when he's more fat and bloated or not? So I'm not really sure what they're trying to go for there.
I think that'd be the most dangerous job in the world, Un's stunt double or body double. You know, like, is that a job you sign up for? What are the perks?
Yeah, a lot of people had them, and, you know, you're going to get shot at, but I like to think it paid well, so there's that going on. You're going to eat in North Korea. Can't say that for most people.
That's true. That's true. Well, how long ago was it when obesity was a sign of wealth and distinction? When did that switch flip?
Yeah, I think I talked to somebody and he mentioned that tailors were making cuts of suits wider about 100 years ago when we figured out some tricks in agriculture to bump up yield and maybe not have famine as much. But I mean, if you go to museums and look at Civil War uniforms, like, you think you're in the boys section of TJ Maxx. I don't know if any of us are in there very much, but it is super skinny. Guys like 120, 130 pounds. So not a very long time that we take food for granted, and especially hyper obesity. I think that's really only a generation or so that we have that going on.
So I hope that gives everyone a taste of what's coming today. Scott has written 12 books. It would take up half the podcast just to go through the names of them, but he's a historian. And the longer that the 24-hour news cycle has existed, the more joy, pure joy, I get out of just listening to history. And it's probably because people don't really change, but the 24-hour news cycle has. And I learned so much more by substantive historical facts. So I'm really glad to have you on the show today. Mm-hmm. And we might talk about things other than this new awesome book that you have, but we'll just kind of see what happens. So it's funny, the timing of this, because Kim Jong-un is one of the main guys in the book. But I'm curious, when you've already written 11 books, how do you decide what number 12 is going to be about? How do we get to this point?
Imagine if Joe Exotic from Tiger King were your emperor.
You have everyone's unfiltered attention. Go.
Well, we have Joe Exotics who were emperor, who held life and death over people. One guy who is actually pretty recent had an 80-foot-tall golden statue of himself that always rotated to face the sun. And we have many, many other cases of this. So what I tried to do was think, what would it be like to be ruled by somebody like this? If you think of how Hollywood celebrities are out of touch, like a Gwyneth Paltrow or Charlie Sheen or whatever, what if they had a goon squad? What if they could have people killed? What would it be like to be ruled by someone that? So that's what I try to do, and also say that I get it. Our current politicians, they're weird. They do weird things. I'm not going to argue that, but we don't have it nearly as badly as some people did in the past.
They are weird.
Yes.
But they've said politics is Hollywood for ugly people. So I repeat myself. Yeah. It's weirdos. I've got a lot of random notes here of things I would like to touch on, but you go from Lincoln to Churchill being, you know, depressed, even suicidal. You talk about how Martin Luther King and Gandhi attempted suicide in their youth. And then you go into the common characteristics of people like Hitler, Stalin, Jim Jones, and Charles Manson, and their ideological similarities aside. It is interesting. I did a really good interview with a writer from Spectator. I can't remember his name just because we're talking right now, but it was about Jim Jones. And it came out about a year ago, and he spent, it should be a documentary. It bums me out that it's not. But he wrote 600 pages on all the things about Jim Jones that no one ever talks about. And so I'll link it here in the video. But the fact that the guy, you know, abused animals growing up, that he was from a broken home, that he got in trouble for fighting and for doing kind of really bad stuff like the Parkland shooter did. And then as he got older, he dabbled in a lot of different types of things. He got into church and the Black Nationalist movement because it was the quickest way to power. And he was adored and loved by all the powerful politicians and players in California, until they had this come to Jesus moment where he started killing people. And it was the same thing with Hitler. As soon as he starts murdering people, everyone goes, oh, yeah, about that. So he was a pretty good guy, but we all knew something was really wrong with him. And as I was talking to him, I thought, what would it be like? Like, what would enamor people into joining this cult? What were their reasons for following this person and putting their hopes and dreams in them? And someone, and I'm random, I go all over the place. I tie that into something I read on Twitter yesterday when I was reading your book. Someone who said, you know what, everyone who has a problem with Trump needs to remember that Obama was the Black Trump. He was a sociopathic, narcissistic, the next word I can't repeat, but he said it, who did nothing for the people who idolized him. And I actually don't agree with the last part for Donald Trump, but do these leaders in this book, do they say more about us as people? Did we do something to deserve the leaders that we have? They often talk about how leaders are a projection of the people, especially if they vote for them, which some did, some didn't. But the more I read it, the more I think, what did I do to deserve this? Is that the only thing you can do if you're under a guy like Tsar Nicholas or the Mad King or King George? Like, what did I do, God? How did I end up here? And why is this the guy who's your holy authority?
That is true sometimes, and sometimes it's not true. A lot of insane rulers in the past, especially in antiquity and the Middle Ages, were there for absolutely no other reason than because they were born there. And a family wanted to keep a dynasty going, and they didn't want their dynasty to break. And keeping it going meant putting an heir on the throne, even if they're not mentally well. At best, you can hope for somebody else will really hold the power, what we call a regent, an uncle, some other advisor that controls things, but the son or daughter is a figurehead, so you can keep the dynasty going and not losing your land holdings. Now, what that leads to, it sounds simple in practice, right? But what it leads to is someone like Charles VI of France. He rules in the 1300s. He thinks that he's made of glass. Why does he think he's made of glass? Well, he thought that he was made of glass so that when his advisors would come around him, they'd have to tiptoe. He thought that he would shatter. He wouldn't take a bath for the same reason. And he probably had some sort of genetic issue. Maybe he had a blood disease called porphyria that a lot of other kings and queens had in Europe. They all sort of faintly interbred, so that pops up a lot. It probably had an issue to do with, at the time, priests used the analogy of glass a lot. They would say to be as pure as glass, to be clean as glass. Glass was sort of a new thing in the Middle Ages. You had windows, and people were fascinated by this technology. So this analogy was used a lot, and some people would hear that analogy, and they would hear it so much that they couldn't really separate fact from fiction and think that they were made of glass. It's not too different from after aliens started appearing in movies in the 50s, when you see a huge spike in people claiming they were abducted by aliens. And when they describe what the aliens look like, it sounds exactly like the xenomorph from Aliens. So they see or hear something, and they can't separate fact from fiction, and that's what gives you a Charles. There's other monarchs I could mention, too, but just to get back to your question, some people are there just by accident of birth, and there's nothing that the people there do to deserve it. Other people in the modern era, you get authoritarian dictators. They're not there because of a dynasty, although the Kim family in North Korea does fit that. They manage to seize power, and there is a little bit of people being in awe of them and people supporting them. And it's not exactly a democracy. You can't easily vote that person out of office. But there's at least sort of there is a charisma to a number of these people that do allow them to hold on to a power for a certain amount of time. I won't deny that. I mean, someone I could think of, it's probably the darkest person in the book, is Idi Amin, the butcher of Uganda.
Go into that. I think most listeners are probably least familiar with him of all the other ones that you chose. So let's hear it.
If you want an idea, there's a movie called The Last King of Scotland that looks at him. A terrifying movie. But He's the second ruler of independent Uganda. He overthrows the president through a military coup. Something like 200,000 Ugandans are killed by him. And there's not that many people in Uganda. So proportionally, he probably killed more than Hitler did, if you're just looking at your own nation state. He is sending people to torture chambers who are his political opponents. And then he's just sending anyone who's not 200% in favor of him. The whole country feels like a police state. You don't know who's a paid informant, who's not, who's part of his goon squad. You might talk to your neighbor about how you don't like Idi Amin, but you don't know if his daughter might be a paid informant and rat you out to the secret police and you could be killed. Well, he was terrifying on one hand, but he had a public persona as being a man of the people. He would go on the radio, he'd give these long speeches like a Fidel Castro did or other people. He also was a folk hero to some people because he would make fun of Great Britain all the time. Great Britain used to, for lack of a better term, own Uganda as one of its colonies. And in turn, he would make fun of them. He once sent a boatload full of bananas to Great Britain to thank them for the good old days of colonialism. During Queen Elizabeth's Silver Jubilee, to commemorate her 25 years in power, he asked for a 25-year-old pair of her undergarments. So he could be the sort of like charming buffoon on stage to the international press and make himself up to be this folk hero who's a true son of Africa, pushing back against the white colonial masters. So he had some kind of base of popular support on one hand, but then on the other hand, it was ruled people through absolute terror. So it's not easy how people like this hold on to power, but they could sort of do it in that way that you mentioned it.
When you're talking about Kim Jong-il, you mentioned that he was sadistic. I should preface this by saying that the psychiatrist labeled the Big Six, diagnosis of personality disorders, which includes sadistic, paranoid, antisocial, narcissistic, schizoid, and schizotypal. Hopefully I said all those right, because I don't know how to say all of them. I think I have a few of them, but I don't know how to describe them all. And the inability to maintain relationships, whether due to fear of others or complete indifference. And then you mentioned Saddam Hussein, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler had those traits. And as you were talking about authoritarianism versus family dynasty or regents, it's interesting that, you know, so the Hussein family, I believe, was originally elected into power. Stalin came through Lenin, who was elected into power. Or, I mean, there was the Bolshevik coup, but he was very popular among the people. And Adolf Hitler, elected to power. And you can talk about those people, but when you mention these traits and you're talking about the guy in Uganda, I think about people that I've known that I've worked with, who, if you put them in power, probably wouldn't be that different. I mean, you're sitting here describing it, and I think, I knew a guy just like that. Like, he used to invite me over for ribs, and I think, nah, I think Monday through Friday is good enough. Or you watch Dateline, you know, and you've got these BPD geniuses who kill their entire family and empty their bank accounts, and their neighbors go, he was the nicest guy. Like, I still can't believe it. There's no way. OJ's innocent. And I'm reading the book, and I think, again, is this just a reflection of us? I mean, if we had absolute power, if I was King Charles and glass was the coolest thing on planet Earth, wouldn't I tell everyone I was made of glass? Or is this, I mean, even is this like some kind of Joaquin Phoenix giant joke? Like, I'm quitting acting because I'm so sick of it. And 3 years later, you find out he did it because he was just bored. And everyone, and if you're an actor, no one ever tells you no. Like, do they just have nothing else to do? I'm trying to wrap my head around they make them heroes. They make them gods. People have to be afraid of you. So at some point, don't you just have to play the part? Give us an example from another ruler in your book. Help me understand if I'm right or wrong.
Right. And it is fun to psychoanalyze and ask, is there a little bit of this in me? Is there a little bit of Caligula or Kim Jong-il in all of us that's just waiting to get out, you know, if the right thing happens?
Wouldn't I like get people to admit that I'm made of glass? Like, wouldn't that be fun? Like, tell me I'm made of glass. You're made of glass. I'm like, of course I am.
Right.
Go grab that girl.
And you're going to be executed if you disagree. So I'm made of glass, right?
Grab three of those schoolgirls and bring them to my chambers. Joe Biden wants to smell their hair. Like, oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir, glass, sir. Like, what's the difference? It's all McDonald's, as Jim Gaffigan would say.
So I'll introduce one who is, for lack of a better term, my favorite in this book. And I think he can show how this happens with somebody. How do you go from a seemingly normal person to completely crazy and bonkers? And you wonder, how does somebody get like that? And that could that happen to any of us? And I think it could. And that is a recent president of Turkmenistan. His given name is Saparmurat Niyazov, but he was given the honorary name Akbar Turkmenbashi, which means the great leader of all Turkmen, It would be like if a president in America called himself Red, White, and Blue Super Eagle or something like that, just totally over the top. And so a bit about him, he was the leader of the Turkmen Soviet Socialist Republic back when Turkmenistan was part of the USSR. It gains independence in the early 90s. He's the first president. He learned about politics from the Joseph Stalin School of Politics. So it's endless self-promotion. You have statues of yourself in town squares. You have posters of yourself in town squares too. But he takes it to a completely different level. He renamed days of the week and months of the year after himself and his mother. He renamed an asteroid after himself. He renamed a city after himself. He had a brand of his own vodka, Turkmenbashi vodka, that was sold. What else? He wasn't completely literate. He couldn't read or write, but he decided, I have a lot of very important ideas to share with people, so I'm going to write a holy book that is going to outsell the Quran and the Bible put together. It's going to be called the Ruhnama, and oh, by the way, check this out. God himself appeared to me in a dream and said, anyone who reads this book three times is automatically going to go into heaven. So for a while, if you were a lawyer or a doctor, if you were a lawyer and wanted to pass your bar exam in Turkmenistan, there was a section in your bar exam with questions about this book. If you were a truck driver applying for your CDL, there was a section in the CDL exam about this book. And I think what got him to this point where he did things and said things that if you or I did them and said them, people would laugh at us, and they should laugh at us because it's ridiculous. I think in his own way, there's this weird innocence where he thinks that what he's doing is good for his country. That Turkmenistan, it doesn't have a long history in the sense that they were semi-nomadic for a long time. So their history is different than that of Europe with universities and technology and all these different things. So I need to give the people a national hero to rally around. Oh, hey, that's me. Okay, I'll give them myself.
Who better for the job than me? Pierre right. Delecto. Like, I'm the guy. Yeah,
right. Exactly. So I would like to think that he started as a cold, hard cynic, this mastermind in the late 80s, early 90s. But when you're in power long enough, kind of like a celebrity, when you're sealed off from criticism and there's no one to really tell you no, over time, you start to believe what you say and you violate the fundamental law of politics, which is to never believe your own press. But he does believe his own press. And then his press is basically law, essentially. And then it's enforceable by punishment. So there's this childlike innocence that what you're doing is good for people. And one last thing with that is with the Kim family in North Korea, there's a political philosophy called Juche. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But it's sort of like the leader is the symbolic representation of the collective will of the people. So what the collective will of the Korean people is made manifest and appears in its leader. So what the leader wants is really what the people want. If the leader lives a high-flying lifestyle, well, if he shows off his greatness, it's ultimately good for the people. It's a strange idea, but that's where, if you really believe that philosophy, then if you claim that you shot 3,600 par the first time you golfed or whatever, like the Kim Jong-il did, in his mind, he can think, well, I'm really showing off the greatness of the Korean people. So it makes perfect sense that I would say something like that. So with that type of mental gymnastics, you can justify doing absolutely absurd things. So yeah,
I'm sorry to interrupt. I remember I have a Kim Jong story when, you remember I think it was the Women's World Cup about 12 years ago, 8 years ago, you know, multiple of 4 years ago, when the North Korean women were losing like 9-0 in the first half, and they wanted to make sure that they announced over the broadcast that Kim Jong was sending instructions to the coach to make sure that he was coaching the team correctly. And I thought, in North Korea, that must fly. Like, to the rest of us, that's hilarious. But there they go, oh, thank goodness. It could be a lot worse. Kim Jong's finally back in charge. He was gone right for the first 35 minutes, which is why they're down 9-0. Not because this is the first time they ever played soccer, breathing free air.
It's like Moses. He lifts his hands and they start winning and they keep winning until he lowers his hands and then they stop winning again. Yeah. Something like that.
But I had made a decision before. Maybe it's obvious. Everything I've read so far is really, really interesting, and I encourage people to go out and get it. But I like to just juxtapose that with, do we still see this today? Just on a smaller scale. And on Twitter, I get in arguments and I talk about how basically all the bad people we've seen, they live somewhere in our zip code. Like, we just have a system in place to keep them from getting power, which is sad because sometimes they slip through the cracks. Like, you do have Corn Pop who lives in, who gets to DC and stays there riding Amtrak for 40 years and is going to be the Democratic nominee, even though he likes to sniff little girls' hair. Like, you look at that guy and go, how did they get through the cracks? Oh, yeah, because maybe they're all that way a little bit. Maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about this guy naming streets after himself and naming a, you know, a day after his mother. I'm like, Oedipus Complex, Robert Byrd in West Virginia. Half the state is named after the guy. Like, if I were a politician, would I be tempted to say, yeah, that bridge, that street, that school, they don't say Byrd on them. Can we get that fixed? I'm going to Washington. You talk about, you know, this megalomania and the savior complex. And I think, well, there's Bill Gates. He wants to save humanity by making sure we don't have any more kids. You have, what's his name in the wheelchair? He wanted to send everyone to Mars. I'm like, you first, man. If you, this is where my Jordan Peterson comes in. If you realize that you're really bad at, we all have a savior complex, but if you're terrible at saving yourself and you figure it out, you move on to animals, then humanity, and then the planet, and then humanity. You got to outsource it or outsize it. So hit us with another example of someone who, and in fact, let me ask you a question. Is there anything, because you've been doing this a long time, is there anything that you learned writing this book that really surprised you or shocked you?
That's a really good question. I think that I looked differently at something where some philosophers have talked about, is there a connection between genius and madness? Arthur Schopenhauer talked about this a lot. And at the beginning of this episode, you mentioned that some of our greatest leaders have suffered mental illness. And I'm not... When I use the word insane, I'm not speaking flippantly. I mean the legal definition of the word insanity. But Abraham Lincoln had well-documented cases of depression. So did Winston Churchill. So did Martin Luther King Jr. And many of their biographers argue that it was because of, not in spite of, that struggle that made them so great. So Abraham Lincoln, because he was able to battle and not be defeated by his inner demons, he could fight the outer demons of war and slavery and accomplish what he did. And so I thought about, okay, who are some people that madness may have led to good things that they did? And if there's sort of a kindler, gentler guy in this book, I think it's King Ludwig II of Bavaria, who was king in the 1800s. And if you've... And built these castles in Bavaria. If you've ever seen Disney World, one of those is based off of his castle in Neuschwanstein. If you go to southern Bavaria or southern Germany, you'll definitely see those castles. It's on the tourism route. And he was a shut-in. I mean, he was given a royal education, really didn't have that many playmates, so he was left by himself, was isolated. It probably stunted him psychologically in different ways. And that's how he continued throughout his life. He was a very quiet, very reclusive person. He loved to imagine. He loved to learn and read about the court of Louis XIV. So he modeled. He commissioned a castle to be built that was a copy of Versailles. He had a number of castles built that are completely useless in the 1800s and basically drained the bank accounts of Bavaria. And he would have his servants, when he would dine alone, set up about four or five places. And he would pretend that he was having dinner with Louis XIV, with Marie Antoinette. So he would speak. He would, in his imagination, be interrupted. He would hear someone say something funny, and then he would laugh at the joke. And his servants are looking at each other out of the corner of their eyes, like, what is going on? And he also liked to go on midnight sleigh rides. He would wake up at 7 p.m. He would have his lunch at midnight. And then he would have his servants hitch up his sleigh and would go through the Bavarian Alps at high speeds, sometimes through blizzards. And he would tell them at different times to stop and get out. We're going to have a picnic because we're at a sunny oceanside resort, even if it's a blizzard going on.
Did you ever see the Chris Rock skit where he did the slave's dilemma? When he's got the slave, I can say this because Chris Rock said it, okay? He did it first. Where he talks about if you were a literate slave, like let's say you're driving, you see a stop sign. You got a big problem because whatever you decide is going to get you killed. Like, that's what I think about when you talk about these Bavarian servants going, yeah, it's balmy 85 degrees, split in the blizzard. Thank you, King. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, yes. Right. I'll have to go back and watch that. That's really funny. So Anyway, on the one hand, he's out of it, but he had a huge imagination. He loved literature. He loved medieval folk tales and stories. So that's why he builds these fairy tale style castles. And today in Germany, if you pick up a Frommer's Guide to Germany or Let's Go Germany and you're visiting, 100 times out of 100, it will tell you to go see Ludwig's castles. It's definitely the symbol of Southern Germany. It's almost the symbol of Germany. And Bavaria was a little bumpkin backwater of Germany in his time. But a lot of things that we associate with Germany today, we associate with Bavaria. We think everyone wears Lederhosen and dirndls. But that's just Bavaria. Germans hate it when you think they all wear that. It'd be like if a foreigner thinks, oh yeah, Americans, they all wear 10-gallon hats and bolo ties. And think, no, man, that's Texas. That's not what's going on. So, and then other things with Ludwig, he was a patron of the arts. He was a patron of Richard Wagner. So his compositions and orchestras exist today because of Ludwig. So in a way, I mean, he was a big dreamer. He wasn't good with money, but a lot of the great art that we have today, the Sistine Chapel, all the things produced in the Italian Renaissance, were produced by wealthy patrons, and he was one of them. So he, in a way, you could say there's a link between genius and madness, and he left some good things behind.
Interesting. Interesting. And that's a fascinating topic. As you were talking, I was thinking about an example that's in the intro of the book of where Neville Chamberlain was a very, what was the word that was used? He was a very intellectual, sane, steady, you know, middle of the road guy. And he went to calm Hitler down and came back and thought he'd succeeded. It took Churchill, a bit of an unwieldy, loudmouth, sort of crazy guy who was also a genius, to manage Britain through the war and save them as a country. And as I read that, I thought, you know, it's funny because in our society, we reward that type of behavior. I read an article yesterday about how Tom Cruise is the greatest actor who ever lived because he's freaking insane and went through all these things, like insane, crazy things that no regular human would do. And he's like, but he's also been on top of Hollywood for 25 years and made some of his best movies in the last 10 years, which I think. So I thought Oblivion was really good. A lot of people crap on it. Like Oblivion and Day After Tomorrow, I thought were awesome. What say you? Did you see either of those movies?
I haven't seen that one, but The Groundhog Day ones where he keeps getting killed and revives, that one is fantastic.
Okay.
And like you said, he's I love the new Mission Impossible movies because since you know it's Tom Cruise doing that, there's a fear element that isn't there for other movies. So his craziness makes for a better movie going experience than someone who isn't as much.
Like we might lose a national treasure. I mean, Henry Cavill, I don't care if he dies, but if we lose Tom Cruise. If anything breaks besides the ankle, yeah, you kind of looked at me like you were picturing jumping on the couch. Oblivion was good, I thought. But I was just thinking, now I've totally lost my train of thought, just thinking back to how our world rewards crazy. Like, you think what's the one for girls now? Fans only? You think of Fans Only and Twitter and celebrity obsession, and it goes back to the whole thing, like, I know people just like this. I mean, shoot, you talk about Caligula worshiping his horse. I'm like, I got people in my neighborhood, on my street, who would pick their cat over my kids if the house were on fire. Like, yeah, they might be crazy, but maybe it's just because we're all a little bit crazy. Is it better to be an anti-hero? Is it better to be a Neville Chamberlain or Winston Churchill? You think about anti-heroes. Like, at the end, I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones or not, but a lot of people were ticked off that Jon Snow didn't get a better ending. I loved his ending. The guy who was self-sacrificing, bastard child, nobody cared him, basically whole life was meant to be discarded. He accomplished everything you could possibly want to accomplish in a life. The love and trust and admiration of his friends, the liberation of his people, and he rode off alone into the icy cold wilderness. And it just kind of reminds me of the prism I look through life, which is that, you know, Jesus Christ was written as a man acquainted with sorrow and grief, and thought, what kind of a life do we want to live? So I like the Ludwig example, but did any of these other guys do anything that's even worth talking about anymore? And did we idolize people that we shouldn't have? I mean, what say you?
Yeah, I think another interesting person who comes out pretty well, I mean, despite his problems, is George III, the villain of the American Revolution. And he had a number of bouts of insanity in his life, the first in the 1760s, and then another one after the Revolutionary War is lost. He probably had the genetic disorder porphyria. It's a blood disease.
That was the incest thing we talked about earlier. Is that the same thing? I wasn't very familiar with.
Yeah, where everyone's sort of second or third cousins amongst all the royals in Europe, and that gets passed around all over the place.
Like the Kennedys. Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly, yeah. So it's the same thing with the Kennedys. There's always an inbred one in the lot that doesn't really come out fully cooked. That was George. Some people think that it was his doctors who did it to him because they found samples of his hair with 200 or 300 times the normal levels of arsenic. We don't know. But when he fell into one of his spells, he would babble for hours. He would talk with the dead. He would get into arguments. Sometimes he would lose those arguments. According to one account, I don't know how accurate this is, he was confusing a tree for the king of Prussia and trying to shake hands with it. He would he loved agriculture and came up with a method of planting meat into the ground and making a tree that would grow meat on its branches. So with its our beef shortage, that would really help out a lot.
Yeah, right, I would vote for that guy. If he pulls it off, I'm a lifer.
But in some ways, people commented that when he would fall into long spells, it would last for months, and then at the end of his life, years of being completely incoherent, and then eventually there's a regency where his son takes over the throne. They say that he never uttered a profane word at his worst periods, and he was a very religious man as well. So it's sort of like his character held through, even though his mind was slipping away. He also didn't have a mistress, which they practically assign you a mistress when you're a royal in the 1800s and the 1700s. And a big patron of the arts, too. He loved Baroque music. He loved Handel. So huge supporter of the arts, supported arts in Great Britain along with that. So it's sort of like it's a thing where that insanity or mental illness, it doesn't make you a bad person. It reveals character. And your point earlier about Neville Chamberlain, very even-keeled, but not the right leader for the time. Jimmy Carter, he's probably the most psychologically healthy president we've ever had. I don't think he would be at the top of anyone's list for best president. So there's a little bit of daring bravado that I think helps out when you're in a position like leadership. I mean, would I want somebody like Winston Churchill as my tax accountant? No, I don't think I would. But I would like a Neville Chamberlain as my tax accountant. But for someone to do a dangerous job inherent leadership, you need someone who strikes that balance well. But it's so easy to go topple and go over the edge and just completely lose it. And that's what happens with a lot of people here.
Yeah, I think one of the quotes Regnery pulled was, "Rulers who were mad by our definition could actually have been responding in the most terrible, reasonable way in those circumstances. From their perspectives, being mad was perhaps the most appropriate way to rule in mad times." I'll probably cut in a clip of Aaron Eckhart going, "We're decent men in indecent times." That's just what the doctor ordered. You know what? Before I let you go, one thing real quick. Who didn't make the list? Give me an honorable mention or two.
Hitler did not make the list. So everyone mentions Hitler, and I almost try to avoid him just because so many of the questions I get are about Hitler, and I don't want to have the Hitler podcast.
Why not?
I know. Let's just talk about Hitler all the time. And what if they had Nazis that won World War II? Let's imagine Hitler all the time. No. So Hitler didn't make the list. Okay. Monstrous guy. I'm not questioning anything there. Killed 6 million. He was paranoid. He had this delusional sense about the Jewish people and what sort of threat they were. And only somebody who is only an unhealthy person, only a mad, insane person could do the Holocaust. But he killed a lot of people. Sadly, in history, there's a lot of people in his company who just kill a lot of people. The Mongols, Genghis Khan, killed a lot more people. But we don't really think of him in that way, maybe because he's farther removed in history. And Dan Carlin makes that big point in his podcast series in Hardcore History on the Mongols. Joseph Stalin killed millions of people. He just hit it better and was more clinical about it, if you want to use that term. So compared to someone like Idi Amin in Uganda, who personally is involved in torture, is personally hacking people to death with machetes, is sadistic and seems to enjoy it in a way that even someone like Hitler doesn't, is something that I think pushes them over the edge. So I like to think there's a difference between brutality and insanity, because someone could be maybe a high-functioning sociopath. They have their faculties about them. They understand reality. They understand they're causing pain and misery. They just don't care. And I think that could be Hitler, someone like that. He for the most part, knew what he was doing. He just didn't care. And there's a lot of people like that, sadly.
Scott, it's been an honor having you on. I encourage everyone to go and subscribe to the History Unplugged podcast, especially if you liked what you heard today. When you find yourself scrolling the gram or watching the Netflix, just chill with Mr. Rank, and I think you'll be glad that you did. Thanks for coming on. Best of luck with your book, and I hope that we see number 12 or 13? This is number 12.
Wow.
So number 13 will probably be coming fairly soon, right? You're already working on it? Actually, you know what? We talked about this in the pre-show. For people who are aspiring productives, like myself, I would like to be productive someday. How do you do what you do? You teased about it earlier, but tell the masses. How do you do it?
Yeah, I learned this from my bro, Isaac Asimov. He had big mutton chops, and he wrote a bunch of books. He wrote 500 books. Yeah, he wrote 500 books, a book every 2 weeks. And the way he did it is that he had a word goal every day, and his were 5,000 words, and he did a full-time job. So he did this for 8 or 9 hours a day. But if you have a full-time job and you want to write a book, just make it something. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be 1,000, it could be 500, it could be 100. You just have to hit your goal. And if you don't know what to say that day and just write, "I hate my life" 20 times or 100 times, stick to the goal no matter what, and that's going to really take you places. So if I had to sum it up, I would just keep it there. That's what Isaac Asimov did, and it was good enough for him, and it's good enough for me.
Awesome. I just have this terrible, unovercomable fear that someone will read what I write, and then I'll never be able to make money again and support my family. So, Scott, thanks again. History Unplugged and Nine Most Insane Rule. The History's Nine Most Insane Rulers. Best of luck with the book tour. We'll talk to you soon.
Appreciate it. Thank you.